The headlines: Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says sanctions are a crime against the Iranian nation and must be lifted immediately. Iran unveils one of its strategic missile bases in the Persian Gulf region, a move officials say is aimed at strengthening the country's deterrent power. Germany reports its biggest rise in coronavirus fatalities, with nearly 1,200 people losing their lives in the past 24 hours. Hello and welcome, everybody. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Seyed Ali Khamenei, says the country is not in a rush for the U.S. to return to the 2015 nuclear deal. Ayatollah Khamenei called the sanctions a crime and treason against the Iranian people and a sign of baseless antagonism against them. Iran's leader made the comments in a televised address to the nation. He voiced support for the authorities' decision to roll back commitments in response to non-compliance by other signatories of the nuclear deal. Ayatollah Khamenei also spoke about Iran's regional presence and said it has helped improve security there. He added the interests of the U.S. and its allies are rooted in regional instability. Ayatollah Khamenei referred to the recent chaos in the U.S. due to an attack on the Congress building there. He said Washington is after creating instability in other countries, and now it has happened on its own soil. The leader also emphasized the importance of Iran's military preparedness and appreciated the country's defensive and missile capabilities. Regarding the coronavirus pandemic, Ayatollah Khamenei praised Iran's efforts to produce a vaccine. He said imports of American and British vaccines are prohibited because they cannot be trusted. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has unveiled an underground missile base along the Persian Gulf coast. IRGC Commander-in-Chief Major General Hossein Salami said the base is one of the several bases housing the IRGC strategic missiles. He said the missiles have a high destructive power and are capable of resisting enemies' electronic warfare equipment. Salami said Iran's logic to defend its territorial integrity and independence is to become strong. However, he added, due to enemies' refusal to accept that logic, Iran has no way but to strengthen its deterrence and offensive powers. The commander stressed that Iran does so to prevent its enemies from imposing their will on it. Last year on this day, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps launched numerous ballistic missiles at Ain al-Assad Air Base that hosted American troops in Iraq's Anbar province. The military strike, which was codenamed Operation Martyr Soleimani, was in response to the killing of Major General Qasem Soleimani by a U.S. drone strike.
On January 8th, 2020, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps launched a barrage of ballistic missiles at Ain al-Assad Air Base that hosted American troops in Iraq's Anbar province. The attack, which lasted 2 hours, was codenamed Operation Martyr Soleimani. It was in response to the assassination of Major General Qasem Soleimani by a U.S. drone strike. All of the missiles hit their designated targets, as American forces failed to intercept any, despite a high level of readiness in U.S. bases across the region in the wake of Iran's pledge to take revenge for the assassination. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, stressed that the attack on Ain al-Assad was just a warning. Meanwhile, U.S. President Donald Trump sought to portray the missile attack as a minor incident. Shortly after the strike, he tweeted, "All is well." Later in a conference in the White House, he tried to play down the strike's magnitude.
"No Americans were harmed in last night's attack by the Iranian regime. We suffered no casualties. All of our soldiers are safe, and only minimal damage was sustained at our military bases."
Controversially, media reports, along with satellite images, showed that the damage done to the base was much greater than what U.S. officials acknowledged. There were also conflicting reports on the number of injuries. Despite initially claiming that the strike resulted in no casualties, the Trump administration ultimately announced that 110 U.S. troops suffered from traumatic brain injuries.
Our shelter filled with dust. Shot into the shelter. Before that, we kind of accepted our fate.
Ain al-Assad base is one of the largest and oldest military facilities in Iraq. After the U.S. invasion of the West Asian country in 2003, the facility became one of the biggest bases for American troops. Since the assassination of General Soleimani, Iraqis repeatedly took to the streets and called for an end to the U.S. presence in their country. Protests were followed by the country's parliament holding an extraordinary session in which the lawmakers voted to expel foreign forces. They called on the government to even revoke its request for assistance from the U.S.-led coalition to fight Daesh terrorists. A year has passed, but U.S. troops are still present in Iraq. Washington claims its military personnel are needed in Iraq to preserve stability. However, history has shown Iraqis otherwise. They saw nothing but death, destruction, and instability since these soldiers set foot in their country.
A year has passed since the unintentional downing of a Ukrainian passenger plane by Iran's defense units. Iran is set to pay compensation while promising justice for those responsible. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Last year on such a day, a saddening incident hit the headlines in Iran. 176 people died in a plane crash minutes after takeoff from Tehran. But further information rattled the country. It was not a crash, but a shootdown. A few days later, Iran's Revolution Guards Corps announced that its units mistook the plane for an intruding American missile, relating the cause of the incident to a human error.
The operator did not look at the plane in the sky. He saw it on the radar screen. That's why he thought that was a cruise missile.
It came less than one day after the IRGC launched a missile strike targeting a United States air base in Iraq as a key forecast against United States assassination of top Iranian military figure General Soleimani. So the IRGC, it was expecting a reaction from the United States, and they shot that airplane down by accident.
The IRGC's confession was then followed by an apology.
I wish I would die and not witness the incident taking place.
On the occasion of the first anniversary of the tragic incident, President Hassan Rouhani stressed that all those culpable in the incident have to face trial.
We said this from day one, that all those responsible for the incident should be tried justly at a court. Today, too, we still lay emphasis, and the judiciary will surely make this happen.
82 Iranians and 63 Canadians were on board the Kiev-bound Ukrainian airliner. There were also Ukrainian, Afghan, British, and German nationals on board. Iran said it has allocated 200 million euros for compensation of the survivors.
Iran and Kiev are still negotiating the amount of the compensation, but what's clear is that Iran has in advance expressed a readiness to pay the compensation. Of course, this could not sedate those who lost their loved ones, but accepting responsibility on the part of Iran is definitely helpful in showing that officials share the sadness and pain felt by bereaved families.
Commemoration ceremonies for the victims have been underway since days ahead of the first anniversary. The IRGC conducted a flyby and dropped flower petals on the crash site in tribute of the victims. Tehran's iconic Azadi Tower hosted a 3D mapping depicting images of all the 176 victims of the disaster. A year after the downing of the doomed plane, the tragedy is still as heart-wrenching, with Iran now referring to the victims as martyrs. Officials in Iran say they're still sorry about the incident, while promising the bereaved families that those responsible will face justice. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Germany has reported its biggest rise in coronavirus fatalities, with nearly 1,200 people losing their lives in the past 24 hours, according to the Robert Koch Institute for Infectious Diseases. The latest jump brings the nation's death toll since the start of the pandemic to almost 39,000. A total of nearly 32,000 new infections were also registered in Germany, with the overall tally edging closer to 1.9 million. The country is currently under a stringent national lockdown, which has been extended until the end of January. However, new infections and hospitalizations continue to increase across Germany, overwhelming the healthcare system, and aide to Chancellor Angela Merkel has warned of a much longer coronavirus lockdown if federal states do not consistently implement tougher restrictions. Watching Press TV's news review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. Stay tuned. On this news review, calls are growing inside the United States for removing President Donald Trump from office over Wednesday's deadly riots on Capitol Hill. The assistant House Speaker said Democrats will impeach Trump unless Vice President Mike Pence invokes the Constitution's 25th Amendment. Catherine Clark said lawmakers in the House are going to proceed with every tool on hand to make sure Trump is removed. She said the proceedings could start as early as next week. The invocation of the 25th Amendment will decide that the president is not capable of discharging his duties and therefore will strip him of his powers. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Professor Emeritus of Law at University of Dayton, Vernelia Randall, joining us from Orlando. Also, we have political activist Michael Santamoro, who's with us from South Carolina. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Professor Randall. What are we looking at right now, and what will the removal of President Donald Trump mean just about, 10 days out before his term ends?
Well, the removal would mean that a message would be sent to all future presidents and the people in our country that sedition by a president would not be tolerated, and that Trump is incapable of doing anything but lying and aggressive action. And so his removal, even if it is on top of his leaving, is important to the nation.
Michael Santamoro, can you explain to us how the process will proceed, how this pans out from this point on, if it's going to happen?
Well, they can draw the articles of impeachment in the House, which may happen, and then they can have then it would have to go to the Senate, and they can still have a trial after Trump leaves the White House. And the reason why they would go to trial after he's no longer president is so that when he's found guilty, he can no longer hold public office. But they would have to have a two-third majority, so they would have to have about 17 Republicans agreeing with the Democrats, who represent about 50 senators out of the 100. And there are Republicans privately would like to see Trump impeached and found guilty so that he has no chance of running again for president in 2024.
Professor Randall, if Donald Trump does get impeached, it's basically the end for him if he wants to hold any future office, and not just for the president himself, but maybe for those around him. It would pretty much bring an end to their ambitions for any future positions in U.S. politics. Am I right?
Take a long time for them to rehabilitate themselves, which some of them are young enough that it's possible in 15, 20 years they could do things to rehabilitate their reputations. But right now, with their reputations being tied to Donald Trump, yes, that would be it. There's another recourse, which I don't think is going to happen at all, is the 25th Amendment. Pence and his cabinet could vote that Trump is incapable of continuing, and you would need two-thirds of the houses to agree with Pence and his cabinet. But if they didn't get their two-thirds vote, one House, which would be the House of Representatives, could delay it for 25 days, and that would be after Trump was out of office. But that's not likely to happen either.
Michael, in the bigger picture, when we're looking at what took place, what is being called now Trumpism, this ideology of white supremacy, chauvinism, racism, xenophobia, what are the underlying causes, the underlying reasons that we're seeing America at this crossroads right now?
Well, there were 74 million people who voted for Trump, and a lot of it is due to xenophobia and nationalistic feelings. There's a lot of, approximately 88% of the people who voted for Trump were of white European ancestry. That's about the bulk of the Republican Party as well. So there is a lot of racism involved, and there's a lot of fear of the population and the demographics of the United States becoming less and less European or less white in decades to come. And that was a big part of Trump's appeal.
Professor Randall, your thoughts on the same issue as well?
Well, I think it's important. I hate calling this Trumpism because it implies that Trump has uncovered something unique and different that he rose up through the force of his personality. The fact is it already exists. It's existed from the beginning of our history. And that what happened was that he gave people permission to be more vocal than they usually are. But the racism in our society was strong before Trump and will continue afterwards, as evidenced by the police killings and by all the disparity, anti-black racism. So Trumpism is something new for white people because some of them are not very aware of the level of racism in our society. But it's not for those of us who have been living with the racism in American society all our lives and all our family lives.
All right, thanks a lot. We're going to leave it there. Professor Vernelia Randall joining us from Orlando. Also, thanks to political activist Michael Santamoro speaking to us from South Carolina. Well, that brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The article you're going to hear has been penned by Robert Lewis. Robert Lewis is a lawyer licensed in California. He has worked in leading US, UK, and Chinese law firms in China for nearly 30 years. The article is titled, Under Biden, US Set to Resume Globalist Policies. Joe Biden's victory in the U.S. presidential election, Donald Trump's America First doctrine will be jettisoned, and Biden will seek to return the United States to pre-Trumpian norms. That is expected to mean a return to the Paris Climate Accord, the Iran nuclear deal, and perhaps even the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Meanwhile, the challenges in the Sino-US relationship will not have magically gone away when Biden takes over, and political matters in relation to China are now so entrenched in the US that no major substantive policy changes may be possible. Fate would have it, Joe Biden and his fellow Democrats again find themselves assuming power in the wake of a global economic downturn. In 2009, it was in the immediate aftermath of the global financial crisis. Now, it is in the midst of a renewed lockdowns across Europe and the United States. In an effort to try to stop the second wave of COVID-19 infections from overwhelming the healthcare system, it will likely take many months into the Biden administration for vaccines to bring the United States, its allies in the other major industrialized nations and other affected parts of the world back to normal. So there are two parts to the Biden administration's goal of getting things back to normal. There is the pre-Trumpian globalist normal, and then there is the pre-pandemic normal. At some point, he and other Western leaders will have to explain why China and other parts of Asia have been back to normal since the late second quarter of 2020, while a return to normal in the United States and Europe now is not projected to occur until at least the third quarter in 2021 at the earliest. Politicians always deflect blame for problems. Donald Trump blamed China for the pandemic. Joe Biden will blame Donald Trump for any pandemic-related problems going forward. In any event, Biden will have to play the cards he has been dealt, and his performance will be measured by actual results. A key component of the global system is trade, and the system is designed to promote more open trade in order to increase global trade volumes and economic development. Donald Trump's America First doctrine is generally understood to be protectionist in nature, and thus presumably anti-trade. His use of tariffs as instruments of trade warcraft similarly has been criticized as antithetical to sound economic and trade principles. However, historical trade statistics over the last decade paint a picture that suggests that continued growth in global trade may not be directly tied to who is in the White House. During the Obama-Biden years, after a steep decline in global export trade volumes in 2009 following the global financial crisis, global exports rebounded rapidly to set new highs for a period of four consecutive years, from 2011 through to 2014, ultimately reaching a peak of $18.9 trillion in 2014. In contrast, in 2015 and 2016, global trade volumes declined by more than 15%, putting global trade levels back on par with pre-crash levels and erasing all the gains in the preceding years. Then comes along a virus. In April of this year, global trade volumes plummeted a remarkable 12.2% in just 1 month. To put this in context, from January of 2010, the monthly change in trade volume had been characterized by an alternating series of small peaks and small valleys, generally with a month-on-month increases of no more than 2.5% and decreases of less than 2%. In light of the precipitous drop in trade volumes due to the pandemic, the World Trade Organization WTO projected in April that trade volumes were set to plunge by between 13% and an almost unimaginable 32% for the full year 2020. This dire forecast by the World Trade Organization experts failed to recognize the apparently unstoppable momentum of global trade, even in the midst of a global pandemic. In May, the monthly decline in trade volume was only 0.9%, and the June trade volumes had jumped back into the plus column, giving 7.9%, followed by smaller but still historically high rates of increase over the next 4 months. By early October, the World Trade Organization had revised its guidance to forecast an overall 9.2% decline in trade in goods for 2020, followed by a 7.2% rise in 2021. The forecast drop for 2020 is still sobering, but pales in comparison with the more than 22% decline in global trade in 2009 after the global financial crisis. The forecast 2020 drop is also smaller than the two-year decline of more than 15% in the last part of the Obama-Biden administration. Some additional historical perspective is required to more fully understand the irresistible force of global trade. Even with the modest decline from 2018, as noted above, global trade for 2019 was still up more than 350% over 1995 levels, which were $5.19 trillion, and a remarkable 6,300% higher than 1970 level of trade, which was $302.3 billion. It appears, at least so far, that not even a pandemic can stop the long-term growth of global trade. As author and columnist Zachary Carabel commented in March, when we assess the prospects for global trade going forward in the full historical context, it would appear more plausible that the most coronavirus future will see not an end to the globalizing trend of recent decades, but a new chapter in the story. Stated otherwise, if Donald Trump and COVID-19 did not derail global trade, maybe nothing can.
Iran Today.
The White House in transition released two New Year statements. While outgoing President Trump reflected on what he called his historic victories, President-elect Biden looked to the future with plans for improvements such as distributing COVID vaccines more quickly. In working our way back to review Iran in 2020, America's historic victories come into play. Trump's accomplishments included frequently ignoring the severity of the pandemic and at times even ignoring the science behind virus transmission. Earlier in 2020, he presented Iran with a New Year gift, the lifeless body of its anti-Daesh general, Soleimani. Soleimani was assassinated on the 3rd of January by a U.S. drone strike in Baghdad. And later in the year, towards the year-end, Fakhrizadeh, an Iranian nuclear scientist, was assassinated. Stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today and running you through the year past. In between assassinations, Iran grappled and is still grappling with the coronavirus like the rest of the world. But whilst under the harshest ever sanctions imposed by the US. In attempting a chronological account of events, I begin with cause of the year's first assassination. Dr. Marandi is going to be accompanying us on this show, and you'll be seeing some of our show guests from past in reviewing 2020.
I think the reasons for the murder of General Soleimani are quite obvious. The Americans were frustrated that they were defeated in Syria. They were supporting ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and so were their allies. And they were hoping to undermine Syria. We know that from the former U.S. Secretary of State, Kerry, when he said we allowed ISIS to advance on Damascus to put pressure on President Assad.
Soleimani was martyred after Trump was impeached, but before his Senate trial. So it was partly a distraction from White House insufficiency and offense. Trump simply mulled over the decision over a round of golf, according to Bob Woodward, the journalist who authored Rage, a book on President Trump.
Soleimani was plotting imminent and sinister attacks on American diplomats and military personnel, but we caught him in the act and terminated him.
This was at a 9th January news conference, a day after the Iranian reaction to the assassination. But how realistic was Trump's explanation? No sooner had he spoken than his own Secretary of State Pompeo contradicted him, saying there were a series of imminent attacks that were being plotted by Qasem Soleimani. We don't know precisely when, and we don't know precisely where. Apparently, that speculation was enough to slay the father and protector against Daesh or ISIS, along with his company of nine, including a man who enjoyed similar reverence in Iraq, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. That was the deputy commander of the Hashd-al-Shaabi paramilitary umbrella group.
So then we saw the Iraqi parliament move to expel, to call on the United States to leave and end the occupation. And we saw the millions of people in Baghdad go to the streets demanding for the end of the U.S. occupation. And during the anniversary of the assassination of General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, again, we saw huge crowds in Baghdad on the night of the terror attack, as well as during the following day. So the response of the Iraqi people was very different from what we would be hearing from Western and pro-Western media outlets and think tanks and pundits.
Soleimani wasn't exactly your run-of-the-mill IRGC commander. He had evolved socially as well as militarily, so it wasn't completely surprising to see women with partially covered hair among the millions of mourners, or for me to see a policeman quietly weeping as he kept an eye on the procession from above, on the pedestrian bridge where we were filming. Soleimani volunteered for the eight-year war of the 80s that Iraq imposed on Iran with generous help and encouragement from world powers. Over the U.S. strike on the Soleimani al-Muhandis Company, Iraq could not remain quiet either. And in the face of growing anger, the Iraqi parliament urged the government to oust the roughly 5,200 American troops stationed in Iraq.
Based on conventions, when a country has military barracks in another country, even legally, but carries out military action in violation of their agreement, the latter's military presence will be deemed illegitimate. Then, the host nation can reverse the agreement and demand that they withdraw their troops. The U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq violated international conventions as well as bilateral agreements. What the U.S. did amounted to human rights violation.
As for the Iranian reaction to the U.S. strike, ballistic missiles fired at Iraq's Ain al-Assad base where U.S. forces were stationed. America's inability to defend itself against the air attack or its unpreparedness was a great historical humiliation for that superpower that has made West Asia its business more than that of West Asian states themselves.
After the assassination of General Soleimani, the Americans sent us messages through diplomatic channels and we responded to them. They also sent mediators who were making efforts so that the Americans decide the timing and the place of retaliation. One of these mediators said that President Trump was even ready to lift sanctions on Iran in return for no retaliation from Tehran.
The Americans had no ballistic missile interceptors in range when on January the 8th, Iran fired 13 ballistic missiles into Iraq at bases housing American troops, 11 of which hit the Ain al-Assad base. It was a warning, and no American or coalition partners were killed. On the same day, that's January the 8th, a Ukrainian passenger jet was shot down shortly after takeoff from Imam Khomeini Airport off Tehran. All 176 people on board flight PS752 lost their lives. It must have been a natural consequence of expecting a U.S. reaction to the Ain al-Assad retaliation. Iran's military said it unintentionally downed the plane, mistaking it for a cruise missile as it turned towards a sensitive site belonging to Iran's IRGC. Ukraine International Airlines denied the plane veered from its expected course before the crash and said officials should have closed the airport. Canada's Foreign Minister Champagne actually alleged he did not believe that the downing of the plane could be blamed on human error, whereas Iran implied there could have been no cover-up as Canada's representatives had visited the site of the crash and had participated in the reading of the plane's black box in Paris. The argument for Iran is pretty straightforward. The downing of the plane was just hours after Iran's retaliation to the Soleimani assassination. So Iran was expecting a possible reaction by the U.S.
Well, the downing of the passenger plane was tragic, but I think it's very clear for any sane person and any fair-minded person that the real culprit is the United States. We have to remember that Trump threatened to destroy Iran. He threatened even to destroy Iran's cultural sites. So when the Iranians retaliated for the assassination of General Soleimani in Baghdad and they fired missiles at the occupation base in Iraq, where the American forces were based, the al-Assad base, the Iranians were expecting an American counterstrike, and the officer who shot down the plane, he made a very, very tragic mistake, and a very horrific mistake. But there is no doubt that if it wasn't for the American murder of General Soleimani, if it wasn't for the constant threats to destroy Iran by Trump, that this would never happen.
Iran is determined to neutralize U.S. hostility. Well, its parliament, for one, is. It was on February the 21st that elections for that new 11th parliament were held, and this is how results looked. 40 independents were elected, 19 reformists and moderates, and as many as 220 principalists. Voters opting for principalists was because they wanted a more decisive approach towards weak Western compliance with the JCPOA, the moderate government's pet project. There has been interesting activity in Parliament or the Islamic Consultative Assembly since, which I will be referring to later in the program. blocking the transfer of medicine or the means to pay for it, that's oil money, or to transfer it. Sanctions through and through. No, actually, you can call it genocide on the sly. Here's who's the culprit and who cares with Corona on the loose. Blocks on medicine and or banking so that Iran can't pay for drugs, raw materials and medical equipment. Culpability begins with the US, but the strain has carried on in Iran. This in spite of the fact that the United Nations Human Rights Commissioner called for the urgent reevaluation of sanctions against countries grappling with the global pandemic. Coronavirus disease, or COVID-19, was first reported from Wuhan in China on December the 31st, 2019. Iran confirmed its first cases on February the 19th, 2020. Those were two positive cases in Qom city. The disease spread rapidly to adjacent provinces and shortly thereafter to all 31 provinces. The Ministry of Health took action by seeing to the formation of the National Committee to Combat Corona. Iran was not alone in its suffering. West Asian economies contracted by an average of around 5% because lockdowns slowed down domestic economic activity and limited global demand. Pandemic-sensitive sectors such as tourism particularly suffered, as did oil prices. And unemployment and poverty that prevailed before 2020 worsened and is foreseen to worsen further in 2021. Most regional governments worked hard to manage the crisis, but carnage was unavoidable, given limited fiscal space. Now, Iran has had U.S. sanctions, be they legal or not, to deal with on top of the pandemic. The country has grown resilient to sanctions that have been ongoing throughout its 40-plus year life of the revolution. But with a maximum pressure campaign, it's surviving by gasping for air.
Let me describe the situation of some countries around Iran these days. Most of them don't have any equipment or device for detecting this virus. And unfortunately, I should say, many of these countries don't even have a healthcare system. They can't even specify a number of infected people. For example, the healthcare system in Pakistan and Iraq are much inferior to that of Iran. In Iran, there are many labs which try to test this virus and other viruses, and our healthcare system is able to check this virus and give report to the World Health Organization every day.
U.S. restrictions on Iran's banking system and oil exports have limited this country's ability to finance and purchase essential items from abroad. That's drugs as well as raw materials and equipment needed to manufacture medicine domestically. Talking illegal, the Trump administration has even reduced the number of licenses it grants companies for certain medical exports to Iran. It is not possible to determine exactly how much U.S. sanctions have affected Iran's capacity to fight a virus, according to Iranian medical workers and global public health experts. It is clear, of course, that Iran has been deprived of equipment needed to control further infection and save lives. Iran has manufactured much, but surely its capacity to control the outbreak has been limited. The U.S. pulled out of the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or Iran nuclear deal in 2018. The deal that was supposed to lift sanctions off Iran in return for Iran limiting its peaceful nuclear program. Yet in 2020, America attempted a resolution to indefinitely extend the UN arms embargo on Iran. That would mean tampering with a provision of the JCPOA, which the U.S. no longer had any business with. But for all its maximum pressure campaign against Iran, the U.S. for once found itself receiving minimal support. The occasion was marked in mid-August as the UN Security Council resoundingly defeated the resolution, leaving Trump's America with support only from the Dominican Republic. In the 75 years of United Nations history, America has never been so isolated, the then Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Mousavi tweeted.
Despite all the pressure applied on Iran, it maintained its regional policy vis-à-vis its Middle East and Anatolian neighbors with which it has normal ties. Owing to deep-seated ties with neighbors, the country was spared serious economic harm, and the economic collapse the U.S. hoped to happen by 2019 did not happen. What is clear is that the Americans have failed in their pressure campaign to bring Iran to its knees.
JCPOA signatory China said, should the U.S. insist, regardless of international opinion, it is doomed to fail like today. Unilateralism receives no support and bullying will fail. Germany, however, ended 2020 by saying outright it did not trust Iran. Now, what might that mean for the JCPOA and Iran's compliance with the deal? Its compliance in limiting nuclear activity, that is.
No one in Iran cares for what anything the Germans have to say. What is important for Iran is the nuclear deal. If the Germans and Western countries want Iran to implement their side of the bargain, then they have to implement their side of the bargain. This is not an act of friendship. This is not a marriage. This is a deal. This is a deal that was negotiated over years. Both sides gave and both sides took.
The Iranian government may have had to struggle with domestic corruption, but external problems alone have been many, beginning with the U.S. pullout from the JCPOA to mostly just verbal compliance by other Western parties to that deal, and all forms of sabotage by the U.S. and or Israel, as assassinations and explosions of nuclear sites. Principalist parliamentarians submitted separate plans to Ghalibaf to withdraw from the JCPOA an additional protocol to the NPT, Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, that is, if it comes to it. Their resolve was intensified by the Natanz explosion and Fakhrizadeh assassination. Here's where I slip with the chronological. The explosion at Natanz uranium enrichment site was a major highlight of the year past. It was the result of sabotage and a tragedy. It caused major damage that would slow down the development of advanced uranium enrichment centrifuges. Natanz, much of which is underground, is one of several Iranian facilities monitored by the IAEA, the UN nuclear watchdog, which certified 15 times that Iran was in full compliance with the nuclear deal. That's till before Iran was pushed into mincing away from its commitments, however reversibly so. Fatality was inflicted not just on a nuclear site, but a nuclear scientist. The last of several nuclear personalities assassinated over the years. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh departed on the 27th of November, 2020. Israel is not lightly suspected of the assassination, as it had marked the name Fakhrizadeh in addressing the world with accusations against Iran years back.
No, I don't think the statement that the Israeli regime carried out the murder of General Fakhrizadeh, Dr. Fakhrizadeh, Professor Fakhrizadeh, I don't think that's speculation. It's pretty clear from Trump's retweets, from what senior American officials, unnamed, said to the New York Times, and from other material that has come out, that the Israelis were involved. And ultimately, the Israeli regime will have to pay a price. But already the Americans are paying a price, because Parliament approved a law to expand Iran's nuclear program as a result of this murder and terrorist attack.
In my opinion, there are two goals behind this assassination. It's a general goal that those seeking to restrict Iran's military industry have stepped in to turn their demands into an operational stage and thus assassinate the father of Iran's military industry. This has been a large-scale goal. The second goal was tactical. They seek to force Iran to make a rash reaction to this event. Basically, Mr. Trump is working with Israel to make Iran do something that would make it fundamentally impossible to return to the deal.
Thank you. With all that's come to pass, non or weak compliance with the JCPOA by Western parties to that deal, assassinations and sabotage, Parliament decided to put an end to a one-way game. Here's how. Iranian Parliament is resolute it will lift sanctions off Iran or ditch the deal. Its resolution is named Strategic Action to Lift Sanctions. The 1st of December saw MPs approve the outlines of that bill. This followed a phased reduction in Iran's commitments to the JCPOA, given what President Rouhani called the E3's support for the constant intensification of cruel American sanctions against Tehran.
Well, the Parliamentary Act was in response, partially, to the murder of Professor Fakhrizadeh, and it was a form of punishment. It was telling the United States that when you condone murder, when you give a green light to murder, this is the response that you get. But it is also sending a second message, and that is to Biden. And that is that if Biden wants to implement the nuclear deal, he can do it on day one. He can give presidential decrees and reverse everything that Trump has done within one day. His lawyers actually could be doing that right now. That was his intention. And the Iranians are saying, if you do not do so, that means you're buying time and you're playing games. And we are going to expand our nuclear program as a result.
According to the nine-article bill, the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, AEOI, will be required to produce and store at least 120 kilograms of enriched uranium with 20% purity at the Fordo nuclear facility every year to fulfill the country's peaceful industrial demands. Also, the organization is to increase the monthly output of enriched uranium for various peaceful purposes with different purity levels by at least 500 kilograms. And it is to increase the number of centrifuge machines to 1,000 within a year after the ratification of the bill. The bill also necessitates the inauguration of a metallic uranium factory in Isfahan within 5 months and restoration of a 40-megawatt heavy water reactor in Adak, which was supposed to be redesigned and optimized under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The bill requires the government to prevent any foreign access and monitoring beyond the additional protocol and to suspend the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, 3 months after the ratification of it. Once again, that is if the parties to the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers fail to uphold their obligations under the deal.
The fact is that the impacts of the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA and the intensification of sanctions on the Iranian society are quite obvious. We no longer accept negotiating on anything other than the nuclear issue. It's very natural. The other side is not trustworthy and has always been so.
That's all we've got on 2020 today. We will be back to cover events in the new year each week at the same time, so do tune in. Happy New Year.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.